with a respectable address and facade, its own kitchen and bathroom, and in walking distance of a pool hall on 31st Street. He did not plan to hustle in that pool hall. It was one of two places where he hoped to meet a member of his first family. Lazarus found what he needed, but on Armour Boulevard rather than Linwood, and rather far from that pool hall. This caused him to rent two garaging spaces, difficult as Kansas City was not yet accustomed to supplying housing for automobiles. But $2 a month got him space in a barn close to his apartment. $3 a month got him a shed behind the pawn shop next to the idle hour billiard parlor. He started a routine. Spend each evening from 8 to 10 at the pool hall. Attend the church on Linwood Boulevard that his family had attended, did attend. Go downtown mornings when business required by streetcar. Lazarus considered an automobile a nuisance in downtown Kansas City, and he enjoyed riding streetcars. He began profit-taking on his investments, converting the proceeds into gold double eagles and saving them in a lockbox in a third bank, the Commonwealth. He expected to complete liquidation with enough gold to carry him through November 11, 1918, well before his July departure date. In his spare time, he kept the landaulette shining, took care of its upkeep himself, and drove it for pleasure. He also worked slowly, carefully, and very privately on a tailoring job, making a chamois skin vest that was nothing but pockets, each to hold one $20 gold piece. When completed and filled, the pockets sewn shut, he planned to cover it, inside it out, with a suit vest he had used as a pattern. It would be much too warm, but a money belt was not enough for that much gold, and money that clinked instead of rustled was the only sort he was certain he could use outside the country in wartime. Besides, when filled, it would be almost a bulletproof vest. One never knew what lay around the next corner, and those Latin American countries were volatile. Each Saturday afternoon, he took conversational Spanish from a Westport high school teacher who lived nearby. All in all, he kept pleasantly busy and on schedule. That evening, after locking his Ford landaulette into the shed back of the pawn shop, Lazarus glanced into the Bierstube adjoining it, thinking that his grandfather might have a stein of Mühlbach there before going home. The problem of how to meet his first family easily and naturally had occupied his mind from time to time all winter. He wanted to be accepted as a friend in his home, but could not walk up the front steps, twist the doorbell, and announce himself as a long-lost cousin, nor even as a friend of a friend from Paducah. He had no connections with which to swing it, and if he tried a complex lie, he was certain his grandfather would spot it. Thus he had decided on a pianissimo double approach: the church attended by his family, except his grandfather, and the hangout his grandfather used when he wanted to get away from his daughter's family. Lazarus was sure of the church, and his memory was confirmed the first Sunday he had gone there, with a shock that had upset him even more than the shock of learning that he was 3 years early. He saw his mother and had momentarily mistaken her for one of his twin sisters. But almost instantly he realized why. Maureen Johnson Smith was the genetic mother of his identicals as certainly as she was his own mother. Nevertheless, it had shaken him, and he was glad to have several hymns and a long sermon in which to calm down. He avoided looking at her and spent the time trying to sort out his brothers and sisters. Twice since then he had seen his mother at church, and now could look at her without flinching. I could even see that this pretty young matron was compatible with his faded image of what his mother ought to look like. But he still felt that he would never have recognized her had it not been for his sharp recollection of lapis lazuli and Lorelei Lee. He had illogically expected a much older woman, more as she had been when he left home. Attending church had not resulted in his meeting her or his siblings, although the pastor had introduced him to other parishioners. But he continued to drive his automobile to church against the day when it might be polite to offer her and his siblings a ride home. 6 blocks, over on Benton Boulevard. The spring weather will not always be dry. He had not been as certain of his grandfather's hangout. He was sure that this was where Gramp used to go 10 or 12 years later. But did he go here when Woody Smith was, is, not yet 5? Having checked the German beer parlor, and noted that it had suddenly changed its name to the Swiss Garden, he went into the pool hall. Pool tables were all in use. He went back to the rear, where there was one billiard table, a card table, and one for chess or checkers. No pool game being available, it seemed a good time to practice some mistakes at three cushion. Gramp. His grandfather was alone at the chess table. Lazarus recognized him at once. Lazarus did not break stride. He went on toward the cue rack, hesitated as he was about to pass the chess table, looked down at the array. Ira Johnson looked up, seemed to recognize Lazarus, seemed about to speak, and then to think better of it. "Excuse me," said Lazarus. "I didn't mean to interrupt." "No harm?" said the old man. How old? To Lazarus, he seemed both older and younger than he ought to be, and smaller. When was he born? Almost 10 years before the Civil War. "Just fiddling with the chess problem." "How many moves to mate?" "You play?" "Some," Lazarus added. "My grandfather taught me, but I haven't played lately." "Care for a game?" "If you want to put up with a rusty player." Ira Johnson picked up a white pawn and a black, put them behind his back, brought them out in his fists. Lazarus pointed, found that he had chosen the black. Gramp started setting up pieces. "My name is Johnson," he offered. "I'm Ted Bronson, sir." They shook hands. Ira Johnson advanced his king's pawn to 4. Lazarus answered in kind. They played silently. By the 6th move, Lazarus suspected that his grandfather was recreating one of Steinitz's master games. By the 9th, he was sure of it. Should he use the escape Dora had discovered? No, that would feel like cheating. Of course a computer could play better chess than a man. He concentrated on playing as well as possible without attempting Dora's subtle variation. Lazarus was checkmated on White's 29th move, and it seemed to him that the master game had been perfectly reproduced. Wilhelm Steinitz against some Russian. What was his name? Must ask Dora. He waved to a marker, started to pay for the game. His grandfather pushed his coin aside, insisted on paying for the use of the table, and added to the marker, "Son, fetch us 2 sarsaparillas." "That suit you, Mr. Bronson? Well, the boy can fetch you a beer from those Huns next door." "Sarsaparilla is fine, thank you." "Ready for revenge?" "After I catch my breath." "You play a tough game, Mr. Johnson." "Huh. You said you were rusty." "I am. But my grandfather taught me when I was very young, and played me every day for years." "Do tell. I have a grandson I play. Tyke isn't in school yet, but I spot him only a horse. Maybe he would play me, even." "Hmm. You'll allow him a night, same as I do." Mr. Johnson paid for the drinks, tipped the boy a nickel. "What business are you in, Mr. Bronson, if you don't mind my asking?" "None at all. In business for myself. Buy things, sell things, make a little, lose a little." "So, when are you going to sell me the Brooklyn Bridge?" "Sorry, sir, I unloaded that last week. But I can offer you a bargain in Spanish prisoners." Mr. Johnson smiled sourly. "Guess that'll teach me." "But Mr. Johnson, if I told you I was a pool hall hustler, you wouldn't let me play chess with your grandson." "Might not. Shall we get set up? Your turn for White. With the first move allowing him to control the pace, Lazarus made a slow, careful build-up of his attack. His grandfather was equally careful, left no openings in his defense. They were so evenly matched that it took Lazarus 41 moves and much skull sweat to turn his first move advantage into a mate. Play off the tie? Ira Johnson shook his head. 2 games tonight is my limit. 2 like that is over my limit. Thank you, sir. You play a fine game. For a man who is, rusty. He pushed back his chair. Time for me to head for the stable. It's raining. So I noticed. I'll stand in the doorway and watch for the 31st Street trolley. I have my automobile here. I'd be honored to run you home. Hey? No, no need to. Only a block from the car line at the other end. And if I get a little damp, I'll be home and can get dry. More like 4 blocks, and you'll be soaked, Gramp. Mr. Johnson, I'm going to crank up the flivver anyhow, to go home myself. It's no trouble to drop you anywhere. I like to drive. In about 3 minutes, I'll pull up in front and honk. If you're there, fine. If you aren't, I'll assume that you prefer not to accept rides from strangers and will take no offense. Don't be touchy. Where's your automobile? I'll come with you. No, please. No need for both of us to go out in the rain for a one-man job. I'll slide out the back through the alley. Then I'll be at the curb almost before you reach the front door. Lazarus decided to be stubborn. Gramp could smell a mouse farther than a cat could. And we wonder why Ted Bronson kept a garage at hand when he claimed to live a driving distance away. Bad. How are you going to handle this, bub? You've got to tell Grandpa a passel of lies or you'll never get inside that house, your own home, to meet the rest of your family. But complexity is contrary to the basic principle of successful lying, and Gramp is the very man who taught you that. Yet the truth could not serve, and keeping silent was just as useless. How are you going to solve this? When Gramp is as suspicious as you are and twice as shrewd. Ira Johnson stood up. Thank you, Mr. Bronson. I'll be at the front door. By the time Lazarus had his landaulet cranked, he had settled on tactics and outlined a long-range policy. A. Drive around the block. This wagon should be wet. B. Don't use this shed again. Better to have this puddle jumper stolen than to leave a hole in your cover story. C. When you surrender the shed, see if Uncle Dattelbaum has his old set of chessmen. D. Make your lies fit what you've said, including that too hasty truth about who taught you to play chess. E. Tell as much truth as possible, even if it doesn't sound good, but damn it, you should be a foundling. And that doesn't fit having a grandfather, unless you invent complexities, any one of which might snap back and catch you out. When Lazarus sounded the klaxon, Ira Johnson darted out and scrambled in. Where now? Asked Lazarus. His grandfather explained how to reach his daughter's home and added, pretty ritzy rig to call a flivver. I got a good prize for the Brooklyn Bridge. Should I swing up to Linwood or follow the car tracks? Suit yourself. Since you've unloaded the bridge, you might tell me about these Spanish prisoners. Good investment? Lazarus concentrated a while on getting his vehicle headed down the tracks, while avoiding the tracks themselves. Mr. Johnson, I evaded your question about what I do for a living. Your business. I really have hustled pool. Again, your business. And I ran out and let you pay the table fee a second time, as well as letting you pay for the pop. I did not intend to. So, 30 cents plus a nickel tip. Knock off 5 cents the streetcar would have cost me. That makes your half 15 cents. If it worries you, drop it in his cup the next time you pass a blind man. I'm getting a chauffeured ride on a wet night. Cheap. This is hardly a jitney bus. Very well, sir. I wanted to get straight with you, because I enjoyed the games and hope to play you again. The pleasure was mutual. I enjoy a game where a man makes me work. Thank you. Now, to answer your question properly, yes, I've hustled pool. Pleasure was mutual. I enjoy a game where a man makes me work. Thank you. Now, to answer your question properly, yes, I've hustled pool in the past. It's not what I do now. I'm in business for myself, buying things, selling things, but not the Brooklyn Bridge. As for the Spanish prisoner con, I've had it tried on me. I deal in the commodities market, grain futures and such. I do the same with stock margins, but I won't try to sell you anything. I'm neither a broker nor a bucket shop operator. Instead, I deal through established brokers. Oh, yes, one more thing. I don't peddle tips. Give a man what seems to me a good tip, and he loses his shirt and blames me. So I don't. Mr. Bronson, I had no call to ask about your business. That was nosy of me. It was meant to be a friendly inquiry. I took it as friendly, so I wanted to give it a proper answer. Nosy just the same. I don't need to know your background. That's just it, Mr. Johnson. I don't have a background. Pool hustler. Not much wrong with that. Pool is an open game, like chess. Difficult to cheat. Well, I do something you might regard as cheating. Look, son, if you need a father confessor, I can tell you where to find one. I am not one. Sorry. Didn't mean to be blunt, but you do have something on your mind. Nothing much, perhaps. It has to do with having no background. None. So I go to church to meet people. To meet nice people, respectable people. People a man with no background otherwise could never meet. Mr. Bronson, everybody has some background. Lazarus turned down Benton Boulevard before answering. Not me, sir. Oh, I was born somewhere. Thanks to the man who let me call him grandfather and his wife, I had a pretty good childhood. But they're long gone, and shucks, I don't even know that my name is Ted Bronson. Happens. You're an orphan? I suppose so. And a bastard, probably. Is this the house? Lazarus stopped one house short of his, their, home. Next one, with the porch light on. Lazarus eased the car forward. Stopped again. Been nice meeting you, Mr. Johnson. Don't be in a hurry. These people, Bronson, who took care of you? Where was this? Bronson is a name I picked off a calendar. I thought it sounded better than Ted Jones or Ted Smith. I was probably born in the southern part of the state, but I can't prove even that. So, I practiced medicine down that way at one time. What county? I know you did, Gramp, so let's be careful with this one. Greene County. I don't mean I was born there, I just mean I was told I came from an orphanage in Springfield. And I probably didn't deliver you. My practice was farther north. But we might have kinfolk. Huh? I mean, excuse me, Dr. Johnson? Don't call me Dr. Ted. I dropped that title when I quit delivering babies. What I mean is this. When I first saw you, you startled me. Because you are the spitting image of my older brother Edward, who was an engineer on the St. Louis in San Francisco, till he lost his air brakes, and that ended his trifling ways. He had sweethearts in Fort Scott, St. Louis, Wichita, and Memphis. I've no reason to think he neglected Springfield. Could be. Lazarus grinned. Should I call you Uncle? Suit yourself. Oh, I shan't. Whatever happened, there's no way to prove it. But it would be nice to have a family. Son, quit being self-conscious about it. The country doctor learns that such mishaps are far more common than most people dream. Alexander Hamilton and Leonardo da Vinci are in the same boat with you. To name just two of the many great men entitled to wear the bend sinister. So stand tall and proud and spit in their eyes. I see the parlor light is still burning. What would you say to a cup of coffee? Oh, I wouldn't want to inconvenience you or disturb your family. It'll do neither. My daughter always leaves the pot on the back of the range for me. If she happens to be downstairs in a wrapper, unlikely, she'll go flying up the back stairs, then reappear instantly down the front stairs, dressed fit to kill. Like a fire horse when the bell rings. I don't know how she does it. Come on in. Ira Johnson unlocked the front door, then called out as he opened it. Maureen, I have company with me. Coming, Father. Mrs. Smith met them in the hall, moving with serene dignity and dressed as if she expected callers. She smiled, and Lazarus suppressed his excitement. Maureen, I want to present Mr. Theodore Bronson, my daughter, Ted, Mrs. Brian Smith. She offered her hand. You are most welcome, Mr. Bronson. Mrs. Smith said in warm, rich tones that made Lazarus think of Tamara. Lazarus took her hand gently, felt his fingers tingle, had to restrain himself from making a deep bow and kissing it. He forced himself to give only a hint of a bow, then let go at once. I am honored, Mrs. Smith. Do come in and sit down. Thank you, but it's late, and I was merely dropping your father off on my way home. Must you leave so quickly? I was simply donning stockings and reading the Ladies' Home Journal. Nothing important. Maureen, I promised Mr. Bronson a cup of coffee. He fetched me home from the chess club and saved me a soaking. Yes, Father, right away. Take his hat and make him sit down. She smiled and left. Lazarus let his grandfather seat him in the parlor and took advantage of the moments his mother was out of sight to quiet down and to glance around. Aside from the fact that the room had shrunk, it looked much as he remembered it. An upright piano she had taught him to play, fireplace with gas logs, mantel shelf with beveled mirror above, a glass-fronted sectional bookcase, heavy drapes and lace curtains, his parents' wedding picture framed with their hearts and flowers, marriage license. And balancing this, a reproduction of Millet's Gleaners, and other pictures large and small, a rocking chair, a platform rocker with a footstool, straight chairs, armchairs, tables, lamps, all crowded and in an easygoing mixture of mission oak and bird's eye maple. Lazarus felt at home. Even the wallpaper seemed familiar, save that he realized uneasily that he had been given his father's chair. An archway, filled by a beat-up portière, led into the living room, now dark. Lazarus tried to recall what should be in there and wondered if it would look just as familiar. The parlor was immaculately neat and clean, and kept that way, he knew, despite a large family. But the living room being used mainly by children, while this room was reserved for their elders and for guests. How many kids now? Nancy, then Carol, and Brian Jr., and George and Mary, and himself. And since this was early 1917, Dickie had to be about 3, and Ethel would still be in diapers. What was that behind his mother's chair? Could it be... Yes, it's my elephant. What are you, little devil? You know you aren't supposed to play in here, and everything must go back into your toy box before you go up to bed. That's a flat rule. The toy animal was small, about 6 inches high, made of stuffed cloth, and gray with much handling. Lazarus felt resentment that such a treasure, his, was entrusted to a young child, then managed to laugh at himself even though the emotion persisted. He felt tempted to steal the toy. Excuse me, you were saying, Mr. Johnson? I said I was temporarily delegated in loco parentis. My son-in-law has gone to Plattsburgh and... Lazarus lost the rest of the remark. Mrs. Smith returned in a soft rustle of satin petticoats, carrying a loaded tray. Lazarus jumped to relieve her of it. She smiled and let him. By golly, that was the Haviland china he had not been allowed to touch until after he got his first long pants. And the company coffee service. Solid silver serving pot, cream pitcher, sugar bowl and tongs, the Columbian Exposition souvenir spoons, linen doilies, matching tea napkins, thin slices of pound cake, a silver dish of mince. How did you do this in 3 minutes or less? You're certainly doing the prodigal proud. No, don't be a fool, Lazarus. She's doing her father proud, entertaining his guest. You are a faceless stranger. Children all in bed? Inquired Mr. Johnson. All but Nancy, Mrs. Smith answered, serving them. She and a young man went to the Isis and should be home soon.
Show is over half an hour ago.
Is there any harm in their stopping for Sunday? Baskin Parlor is on a brightly lighted corner right where they catch their streetcar.
A young girl shouldn't be out after dark without a chaperone.
Father, this is 1917, not 1890. He's a fine boy, and I can't expect him to miss an episode of this serial. Pearl White, and very exciting. Nancy tells me all about it. With a William S. Hart feature tonight, I understand. I would have enjoyed seeing that myself.
Well, I've still got my shotgun.
Father. Lazarus concentrated on remembering to eat cake with a fork.
She's trying to bring me up, Gramp said, grumpily. Won't work.
I'm sure Mr. Bronson is not interested in our family problems, Mrs. Smith said quietly. If they were problems, which they are not. May I warm your coffee, Mr. Bronson?
Thank you, ma'am. That's right, he isn't. But Nancy should be told soon. Maureen, take a close look at Ted. Ever seen him before?
His mother looked over her cup at Lazarus, put it down and said, Mr. Bronson, when you came in, I had the oddest feeling. At church, was it not? Lazarus admitted that such could have been the case. Gramps' brows shot up.
So, I must warn the parson that even if you did meet there...
We did not meet at church, Father. But with hurt in my zoo, I barely have time to speak to Reverend and Mrs. Draper. But now that I think about it, I'm sure I saw Mr. Bronson there last Sunday. One does notice a new face among old familiar ones.
Daughter as may be. That wasn't what I meant. Whom does Ted look like? No, never mind. Doesn't he look like your Uncle Ned?
His mother again looked at Lazarus. Well, yes, I see a resemblance, but he looks even more like you, Father.
No. Ted's from Springfield. All my sins were farther north.
Father.
Daughter, quit worrying about me rattling the family skeleton. It's possible that... Ted, may I tell it?
Certainly, Mr. Johnson. As you said, it's nothing to be ashamed of, and I'm not.
Ted is an orphan, Maureen. A foundling. If Ned weren't warming his toes in hell, I'd ask him some searching questions. The time and place is right, and Ted certainly looks like our kin.
Father, I think you are embarrassing our guest.
I don't. And don't you be so hoity-toity, young lady. You're a grown woman with children. You can stand plain talk.
Mrs. Smith, I'm not embarrassed. Whoever my parents were, I am proud of them. They gave me a strong, healthy body and a brain that serves my needs.
Well spoken, young man.
And while I would be proud to claim your father as my uncle, and you as my cousin, if it were so, it seems more likely that my parents were taken by a typhoid epidemic down that way. The dates match well enough. Mr. Johnson frowned.
How old are you, Ted?
Lazarus thought fast and decided to be his mother's age. I'm 35.
Why, that's just my age.
Really, Mrs. Smith, if you hadn't made clear that you have a daughter old enough to go to the picture show with a young man, I would have thought you were about 18.
I'll go along with you. I have 8 children.
Impossible. Maureen doesn't look her age,
agreed her father.
Hasn't changed since she was a bride. Runs in the family. Her mother doesn't have a gray hair today.
Where is Grandma? Oh, yes. Oh, so don't ask.
But Ted, You don't look 35 either. I would have guessed middle 20s. Well, I don't know exactly how old I am, but I can't be younger than that. I might be a bit older. Quite a bit, Gramp. A bit older. Quite a bit, Gramp. But it's close enough that when I'm asked, I just put down the 4th of July, 1882. Well, that's my birthday. Yes, Mama, I know. Really, Mrs. Smith, I didn't mean to steal your birthday. I'll move over a few days. Say the 1st of July, since I'm not certain anyhow. Oh, don't do that. Father, you must bring Mr. Bronson home for dinner on our joint birthday. Do you think Brian would like that? Certainly he would. I'll write to him about it. He'll be home long before then, in any case. You know, Brian always says, the more the merrier. We'll be expecting you, Mr. Bronson. Mrs. Smith, that's most kind of you, but I expect to leave on a long business trip on the 1st of July. I think you've let Father scare you off. Or is it the prospect of eating dinner with 8 noisy children? Never mind. My husband will invite you himself, and then we'll see what you say. In the meantime, Moraine, stop crowding him. You've got him flustered. Let me see something. You two stand up, side by side. Go ahead. Ted, she won't bite you. Mrs. Smith. She shrugged and dimpled, then accepted his hand to get out of her rocking chair. Father always wants to see something. Lazarus stood by her, facing his grandfather, and tried to ignore her fragrance. A touch of toilet water, but mostly the light, warm, delicious scent of sweet and healthy woman. Lazarus was afraid to think about it, was careful not to let it show in his face, but it hit him like a heavy blow. Both of you step up to the mantel and look at yourselves in the glass. Ted, there was no typhoid epidemic down that way in 82, nor 83. Really, sir? Of course, I can't remember. And I shouldn't have tossed in that flourish. Sorry, Gramp. Would you believe the truth? You might. Out of all the men I've ever known. Oh, don't risk it, bub. Forget it. Nope. Just the usual number of dumb fools too lazy to build their privies a proper distance from their wells, which I feel certain could not describe your parents. Can't guess about your mother, but I think your father died with his hand on the throttle, still trying to gain control. Maureen? Mrs. Smith stared at her reflection and that of their guest. She said slowly, Father, Mr. Bronson and I look enough alike to be brother and sister. No. First cousins. Although, with Ned gone, there's no way to prove it. I think... Mr. Johnson was interrupted by a yell from the front staircase landing. Mama! Gramp! I want to be buttoned up! Ira Johnson answered. Woody, you rapscallion, get back upstairs! Instead, the child came down. Small, male, freckled, and ginger-haired. Dressed in Dr. Denton's, with the seat flapping behind him. He stared at Lazarus with beady, suspicious eyes. Lazarus felt a shiver run down his spine and tried not to look at the child. Who's that? Mrs. Smith said quickly. Forgive me, Mr. Bronson. Then she added quietly, Come here, Woodrow. Her father said, Don't bother, Maureen. I'll pick him up and blister his bottom. Then I'll button him. You and what 6 others? The boy child demanded. Me, myself, and a baseball bat. Mrs. Smith quietly and quickly attended to the child's needs, then hurried him out of the room and headed him up the stairs. She returned and sat down. Her father said, Maureen, that was just an excuse. Woody can button himself, and he's too old for that baby outfit. Put him in a nightshirt. Father, shall we discuss it another time? Mr. Johnson shrugged. I've overstepped again. Ted, that one's a chess player. He's a stem winder, named for President Wilson. But he's not too proud to fight. Mean little devil. Father. All right, if it's true. That's what I like about Woody. He'll go far. Mrs. Smith said,
Please excuse us, Mr. Bronson. My father and I sometimes differ a little about how to bring up a boy, but we should not burden you with it.
Maureen, I simply won't let you make a little Lord Fauntleroy out of Woody.
There's no danger of that, Father. He takes after you. My father was in the War of 98, Mr. Bronson, and the insurrection.
And the Boxer Rebellion.
And he can't forget it.
Of course not. I keep my old Army 38 under my pillow, my son-in-law being away.
I know what I wish him to forget. I'm proud of my father. Mr. Bronson, and I hope that all my sons will grow up with his same spirit. But I want them to learn to speak politely, too.
Maureen, I would rather have Woody sass me than be timid with me. He'll learn to speak politely soon enough. All the boys will take care of that. A lesson in manners punctuated with a black eye sticks. I know from experience.
The discussion was interrupted by the jingle of the doorbell.
That should be Nancy,
Mr. Johnson said and got up to answer. Lazarus heard Nancy say goodnight to someone, then stood up himself to be introduced, and was not startled only because he had already picked out his eldest sister at church and knew that she looked like a young edition of Laz or Laura. She spoke to him politely, but rushed upstairs as soon as she was excused. Do sit down, Mr. Bronson.
Thank you, Mrs. Smith. But you were staying up until your daughter returned. She has, so I will leave.
Oh, there's no hurry. Father and I are not owls.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the coffee and the cake, and most especially the company. But it is time for me to say goodnight. You have been most kind.
If you must, sir, will we see you at church on Sunday?
I expect to be there, ma'am.
Lazarus drove home in a daze, body alert but thoughts elsewhere. He reached his apartment, bolted himself in, checked windows and blinds automatically, stripped off his clothes and started a tub. Then he looked grimly at himself in the bathroom mirror.
You stupid arsefartle, he said with slow intensity. You whirling son of a bitch. Can't you do anything right?
No, apparently not. Not even something as simple as getting reacquainted with his mother. Gramp had been no problem. The old goat had given him no surprises. Other than being shorter and smaller than Lazarus remembered, he was just as grumpy, suspicious, cynical, formerly polite, belligerent, and delightful, as Lazarus had remembered. There had been worrisome moments when he had thrown himself on the mercy of the court, but that gambit had paid off better than Lazarus had had any reason to hope through an unsuspected family resemblance. Lazarus not only had never seen Gramp's elder brother, dead before Woody Smith was born, but he had forgotten that there ever was an Edward Johnson. Was Uncle Ned listed with the families? Ask Justin. Never mind. Not important. Mother had put her finger on the correct answer. Lazarus resembled his grandfather, and his mother, as Gramp had pointed out. But that had resulted only in conjectures concerning dear old Uncle Ned and his trifling ways, ones that Mother did not mind listening to, once she was certain that her guest was not embarrassed. Embarrassed. It had changed his status from stranger to cousin. Lazarus wanted to kiss Uncle Ned and thank him for those trifling ways that made kinship plausible. Grant believed the theory. Of course, it was his own. And his daughter seemed willing to treat it as a possible hypothesis. Lazarus, it's just the inside track you need. If you weren't such a blithering idiot. He tested the bathwater. Cold. He shut it off and pulled the plug. A promise of hot water all day long had been one inducement when Lazarus had rented this musty cave. But the janitor turned off the water heater before he went to bed, and anyone looking for hot water later than 9 was foolish. Well, he qualified as foolish. And perhaps cold water would do more for his unstable condition than hot. But he had wanted a long hot soak to soothe his nerves and help him think. He had fallen in love with his mother. Face it, Lazarus. This is impossible, and you don't know how to handle it.
In more than 2,000 years of one silly misadventure after the other, this is the most preposterous predicament you ever got into. Oh, sure. A son loves his mother. As Woody Smith, Lazarus, had never doubted that. He'd always kissed his mother goodnight, usually. Hugged her when he saw her, if he wasn't in a hurry. Remembered her birthday. Almost always. Thanked her for cookies or cake she left out for him whenever he was out late. Except when he forgot. And sometimes had told her he loved her. She had been a good mother. She had never screamed at him. Or at any of them. And when necessary, had used a switch at once. And the matter was over with. Never that wait till your father gets home routine. Lazarus could still feel that Pete switch on his calves. It had caused him to levitate, better than Thurston the Great, at a very early age. He recalled, too, that as he grew older, he found that he was proud of the way she looked, always neat and standing straight, and invariably gracious to his friends, not like some of the mothers of other boys. Oh, sure, a boy loves his mother, and Woody had been blessed with one of the best. But this was not what Lazarus felt toward Maureen Johnson Smith, lovely young matron, just his own age. That visit this night had been delicious agony, for he had never in all his lives been so unbearably attracted, so sexually obsessed by any woman, anywhere or when. During that short visit, Lazarus had been forced to be most careful not to let his passion show, and especially cautious not to appear too gallant, not be more than impersonally polite, not by expression or tone of voice or anything else risk arousing Gramps, always alert suspicions, not let Gramps suspect the storm of lust that had raged up in him as soon as he touched her hand. Lazarus looked down at proof of his passion, hard and tall, and slapped it. "What are you standing up for? There's nothing doing for you. This is the Bible Belt." It was indeed. Grant did not believe in the Bible or live by Bible Belt standards, yet Lazarus felt sure that were he to provoke it by breaching those standards, Grant would shoot him quite dispassionately on behalf of his son-in-law. Possibly the old man would let the first shot go wide and give him a chance to run, but Lazarus was not willing to bet his life on it. Grant, acting for his son-in-law, might feel duty-bound to shoot straight, and Lazarus knew how straight the old man could shoot. Forget it. Forget it. He was not going to give either Gramp or his father any reason to shoot, or even to be angry. And you forget it too, you blind snake. Lazarus wondered when his father would be home, and tried to remember how he looked. Found his memory blurred. Lazarus had always been closer to his grandfather Johnson than to his father. Not only had his father often been away on business, but also Gramp had been home in the daytime and willing to spend time with Woody. His other grandparents? Somewhere in Ohio, Cincinnati? No matter. His memory of them was so faint that it did not seem worthwhile to try to see them. He had completed all that he had intended to do in Kansas City, and if he had the sense God promised a doorknob, the time to leave is now. Skip church on Sunday, stay away from the pool hall, go down Monday and sell his remaining holdings and leave. Climb into the Ford. No, sell it, and take a train to San Francisco. There catch the first ship south. Send Gramp and Maureen polite notes, mailed from Denver or San Francisco, saying that he was sorry, but that business trip, etc. But get out of town. Because Lazarus knew that the attraction had not been one-sided. He thought that he had kept Grant from guessing his emotional storm, but Maureen had been aware of it and had not resented it. No, she had been flattered and pleased. They had been on the same frequency at once, and without a word or any meaningful glance or touch, her transponder had answered him silently. Then, as opportunity made it possible, she had answered overtly, once with a dinner invitation, which Grant had trumped on. And she had promptly tromped back in a fashion that made it acceptable by the mores. Then a second time, just as he was leaving,
with the also fully acceptable suggestion that she would expect to see him in church. Well, why should a young matron, even in 1917, not be pleased and flattered and unresentful to know that a man wanted most urgently to take her to bed and treat her with gentle roughness? If his nails were clean, if his breath was sweet, if his manners were polite and respectful, why not? A woman with 8 children is bed and treat her with gentle roughness. If his nails were clean, if his breath was sweet, if his manners were polite and respectful, why not? A woman with 8 children is no nervous virgin. She is used to a man in her bed, in her arms, in her body. And Lazarus would have bet his last cent that Marine enjoyed it. Lazarus had no reason then, or in his earlier life, to suspect that Marine Smith had ever been anything but faithful by the most exacting Bible Belt standards. He had no reason to think that she was even flirting with him. Her manner had not suggested it. He doubted if it ever would. But he held a deep certainty that she was as strongly attracted as he was, that she knew exactly where it could lead, and he suspected that she realized that nothing but chaperonage would stop them. But a father in residence and 8 children, plus the contemporary mores concerning what can and can't be done, constituted a lot of chaperonage. Ida's chastity belt could hardly be more efficient. Let's haul it out into the middle of the floor and let the cat sniff it. Sin? Sin, like love, was a word hard to define. It came in 2 bitter but vastly different flavors. The first lay in violating the taboos of your tribe. This passion, he felt, was certainly sinful by the taboos of the tribe he had been born into. Incestuous, in the first degree. But it could not possibly be incest to Marine. To himself? He knew that incest was a religious concept, not a scientific one. And the last 20 years had washed away in his mind almost the last trace of his tribal taboo. What was left was no more than that breath of garlic in a good salad. It made Marine more enticingly forbidden, if such were possible. It did not scare him off. Marine did not seem to be his mother, because she did not fit his recollection of her either as a young woman or as an old woman. The other meaning of sin was easier to define because it was not clouded by the murky concepts of religion and taboo. Sin is behavior that ignores the welfare of others. Suppose he stuck around and managed somehow, stipulate safe opportunity, to bed Maureen with her full cooperation. Would she regret it later? Adultery? The word meant something here. But she was a Howard, one of the early ones when marriage between Howards was a cash contract, eyes wide open, payment from the foundation for each child born of such union, and Marine had carried out the contract. 8 paid-for children already, and would stay in production for, about 15 more years. Perhaps to her, adultery meant violation of contract rather than sin. He did not know. But that was not the point, Bub. The real question is the only one that has ever stopped you when temptation coincided with opportunity, that this time he could consult neither Ishtar nor any geneticist. The chance of a bad outcome was slight when there were so many hurdles in the way of any outcome. But it was the exact risk that he had always refused to take, the chance of placing a congenital handicap on a child. Hey, wait a minute. No such outcome could result, because no such had resulted. He knew every one of his siblings, alive now or still to be born, and there had not been a defective in the lot. Not one. Therefore, no hazard. But that was grounded on the assumption that his no-paradoxes theory was a law of nature. But you've long been aware that the no-paradoxes theory itself involves a paradox.
one that you've kept quiet about so as not to alarm Laz or Lore and the rest of your present, that present, not this one, family. To wit, the idea that free will and predestination are two aspects of the same mathematical truth, and the difference is merely linguistic, not semantic. The notion that his own free will could not change events here and now because his free will actions here and now were already a part of what had happened in any later here and now. Which in turn depended on a solipsistic notion he had held as far back as he could remember. Cobwebs, all of it. Lazarus, you don't know what trouble you might cause. So don't. Get out of town now and don't come back to Kansas City at all. Because if you do, you're certain to try to get Maureen's bloomers off, and she's going to breathe hard and help. From there on, only Allah knows, but it could be tragic for her, and tragic for others. And as for you, you stupid stud, all balls and no brain, it could get your ass shot off, just as the twins predicted. In which case, since you are not going to see your family again, there is no sense in waiting in South America for this war to end. You've seen enough of this doomed era. Ask the girls to come pick you up now. Was her waist really that slender? Or did she lace it in? Shucks, it didn't matter how she was built. As with Tamara, it simply didn't matter. Dear Laz and Lore, darlings, I've changed plans. I've seen my first family, and there isn't anything else I want to do in this era. Nothing worth sweating out most of 2 years in a backwater while this war drags on to its bloody and useless finish. So I want you to pick me up now, at the impact crater. Forget about Egypt. I can't get there now. By pick me up now, I mean Gregorian, 3 March 1917. Repeat, 3rd day of March, 1917 Gregorian, at that meteor impact crater in Arizona. Much to tell you when I see you. Meanwhile, my undying love, Lazarus. Was it her voice? Or her fragrance? Or something else? Da Capo, 4. Home. 27 March 1917 Gregorian. Beloved family, repeat a basic message. I got here 3 years too early, 2 August 1916, but still wish to be picked up exactly 10 T-years after drop, 2 August 1926. Repeat, 6. Rendezvous points and alternatives from basic date as before. Please impress on Dora that this results from bad data I gave her and is not her fault. I'm having a marvelous time. I got my business cleaned up, and then got in touch with my first family by looking up my grandfather, Ira Johnson, Ira, and got acquainted with him first. And with the aid of a horrendous lie and a most fortunate family resemblance, Gramp is convinced that I am an unregistered son of his, deceased brother. I didn't suggest this. It's his own idea. Consequently, it's solid. And now I'm a long-lost cousin in my first home. I'm not living there, but welcome, which is very nice. Let me give a rundown on the family, since all of you are descended from three of them. Gramp, Mama, and Woody. Gramp is described in that junk Justin has been cutting down to size. No changes. Justin, save that instead of being 2 meters tall and carved out of granite, Gramp is almost exactly my size. I am spending every minute with him that he will let me, which usually means playing chess with him several times a week. Mama. Take Laz and Lore and add 5 kilos in the best places, then add 15 T-years and a big slug of dignity. Quit quivering your goddamn chins. Add hair down to her waist, but always coiled up on top. I don't actually know what Mama does look like other than her head and hands because of the curious custom here of wearing clothes all over at all times, and I do mean all over. I know that Mama has slender ankles because I once caught a glimpse. But I would never dare stare at them. Gramp would toss me out of the house. Papa. He is away now, I had forgotten what he looks like. I had forgotten all their faces except Gramp, who uses the same face I do. But I've seen pictures of Papa, and he looks a bit like President Teddy Roosevelt. That's Theodore Athene, not Franklin, in case you have a picture in your gizzards. Nancy. Laz and Lore as 3 standard years before I left. Not as many freckles, and very dignified, except when it slips. She is acutely aware of young males, and I think Gramp is urging Mama to tell her about the Howard setup at once, so that she'll be sure to marry in the families. Carol. Laz and Lore again, but 2 years younger than Nancy. She is as interested in boys as is Nancy, but frustrated. Mama has her on a short leash. Quivers her chin, which Mama ignores. Ryan Jr. Dark hair, looks more like Papa. Rising gun capitalist. Has a newspaper route, which he combines with lighting gas street lamps. Has a contract to deliver advertising handbills for the local moving picture theater, which he farms out to his younger brother and 4 other boys and pays them in tickets to the theater, keeps some for his own use and sells the rest at a discount, 4 cents instead of 5, at school. Has a vending bar for soda pop, a sweet bubbly drink, on the corner in the summers, but plans to franchise this to his younger brother this coming summer. He has another enterprise lined up. As I recall, Brian got rich quite young. Let me explain something about our family. They are prosperous by here and now standards, but do not show it except that they live in a large house in a good neighborhood. Not only is Papa a successful businessman, but also, this is a time when the Howard endowment of babies is substantial in terms of buying power. And Mama has had 8 already. To all of you, being a Howard means a genetic heritage and a tradition. But here and now it means cash money for babies. A stock breeding scheme. And we are the stock. I think Papa must be investing the money Mama makes by having Howard babies. They certainly are not spending it. And this accords with my own dim memories. I don't know what was done for my siblings, but I received getting started money when I first married. Money I had not expected and which had nothing to do with the Howard endowments my first wife earned by being fertile and willing. Since I married during an economic stalemate, this made a big difference. Now, back to the kids. The boys not only do work, they have to work. Or they have nothing but clothes and food. The girls receive very small cash allowances, but are required to do housework and to help with the younger children. This is because it is very difficult for a girl to earn money in this society, but a boy who will get out and try has endless opportunities. This will change before the century is over, but in 1917, it is true. All the Smith kids work at home. Mama hires a laundress one day a week, that's all. But a boy or girl who finds outside cash money work is relieved of housework to that extent. Nor does he have to pay back this time off. He keeps what he earns and spends it or saves it, the latter being encouraged by Papa matching such savings. If you think Papa and Mama are intentionally making money grubbers of their offspring, you are right. George. 10 years old, Brian Jr.'s junior partner, shadow and stooge. This will end in a few years with George busting Brian one in the mouth. Marie. 8 and a freckled tomboy. Mama is having a difficult time trying to make a lady out of her, but Mama's gentle stubbornness and biology will win. Marie grew up to be the beauty of the family, with bows underfoot. And I hated them as there had been a period when I was her pet. Marie was the only one of my siblings I was close to. It is possible to be lonely in a large family, and I was, except for Gramp always, and Marie for a short time. Woodrow Wilson Smith, still short of 5 by several months, and as offensive a brat as was ever allowed to grow up. I am appalled to be forced to admit that this stinking little snot is the weed which grew up to be humanity's fairest flower, namely old Buddy Boy himself. So far, he has spat in my hat, when it was presumably out of his reach, on the cloak rack in the hall, referred to me with various disparagements, of which, "Here's that dude in the derby again," is the mildest. Kicked me in the stomach when I tried to pick him up. My error. I didn't want to touch him, but I thought I should break myself of irrational queasiness. And accused me of cheating at chess, when in fact he was cheating. He called my attention to something out the window, then moved my queen one square, and I caught him at it, and called him on it. And so on, ad nauseam. But I continue to play chess with him because, A, I am determined to get along with all my first family for the short time I will be here, and B, Woody will play chess at any...